Hello, everyone, and welcome today to our special panel on Understanding Gender Ideology, Truth, Science, and Advocacy. So we've got an amazing panel lineup here for everyone today. These are all folks who have actually been on American Thought Leaders before. We're bringing them together to get us up to date on all the newest information around the advocacy, around gender ideology, but also the science, because we're learning more and more about some of the things that kind of have gone wrong in terms of how the science has been communicated to us, and in some cases isn't even science. So we're going to delve into today what parents should know when it comes to gender dysphoria. We're going to talk about what's been called gender-affirming care. We're going to talk about how to safeguard your own children. And, you know, possibly if you have friends that you see some issue that, you know, you may be able to talk to them about this. And also how gender ideology is being challenged at multiple levels, at school boards and state houses, in courts and in the classrooms. And so we're going to follow this all up with a Q&A afterwards. We're going to start all this with Dr. Miriam Grossman. So Dr. Grossman wrote the book Lost in Transnation. Just for full disclosure, this is a book I've officially endorsed, and there aren't many of them. Fantastic book, highly recommended read. And she's an adult psychiatrist and she's also a senior fellow with Do No Harm. And adult psychiatrist, well, definitely a child psychiatrist as well. So Dr. Grossman, let's have your initial remarks, please.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for including me. I'm very excited to be joining you today. I always like to begin these talks with a reminder that sex is established at conception. There are two sexes, and sex is permanent. I always think that it's important to remind people of that, because what we're being told, what students are being told, is altogether a different thing. Now, the fact that sex is permanent and that there are two sexes has always been true, and it will never change. What has changed, however, is that in the past few decades, kids have been introduced to the idea that they could be born in the wrong body, and that it's normal, in fact, to feel like you're born in the wrong body, and that the solution to that condition is to medically and surgically alter the body to fit how you feel. And this is what's called gender-affirming care. The idea that a child or teenager knows best who they are and is able to have these medical and surgical interventions basically on demand, and that the medical practitioner should rubber stamp the child's new identity. We're told that the science is settled. We're told that there's a medical consensus, but this is not true. The science is certainly not settled. There certainly is no consensus. In fact, the idea of being born in the wrong body has no foundation within science or medicine whatsoever. And regarding a consensus, there is a debate, an international debate that is raging, absolutely raging, and it seems to be just getting hotter and hotter by the day. I mean, just in the past 24 hours, there's been very important developments. There isn't really time to go into the details, but let's just put it this way. It seems that almost every day there is more evidence that gender-affirming care, which I just defined, is really a medical catastrophe. And the stakes are very, very high, because gender-affirming care essentially is calling for the sterilization, permanent sterilization of young kids. Now, most people are not aware of this, and they must be. This is one of the many things that I want parents, teachers, and physicians as well, because physicians are misinformed, to understand that this is a path toward permanent sterilization. Now, this is a medical calamity. And if we could pull up that chart of the numbers, the skyrocketing numbers in the past 10 or so years of minors who are presenting at clinics. This happens to be from the clinic in London that was recently closed down. But at that clinic, the busiest, the largest clinic in the world, they saw a 5,000% increase in the numbers of kids showing up, complaining about the physical reality of their sex and wanting to quote unquote transition to the opposite sex or some variety therein. So what we have here, why would this happen? Why would suddenly a condition that used to be so incredibly rare, one in many tens of thousands of individuals, you know, when I was in medical school and doing my residency, this condition of gender, what we now call gender dysphoria, was so rare that I never expected to see even one case in my entire career. And now that's all I do. My practice is devoted to helping these kids and helping their parents navigate this family crisis. Because it is a family crisis when you have a child who, out of the blue, and that, I'm talking about the kids who are what we call ROGD, rapid onset gender dysphoria, without getting into too much detail. But these are the vast majority of kids now who are suddenly out of the blue, coming home, and at the dining room table, they are announcing, "Mom, Dad, I'm not your son, I'm your daughter. I want you to use this new name, new pronouns. I want to go to a gender clinic, and I want to be put on medication." So the stakes are very, very high. We have no evidence that these medical interventions are helpful. We do have overwhelming evidence of harm. And so, you know, if there's one thing that I want the audience to take in today, it's that they must become educated on this issue. They are being led to believe by doctors, by government authorities, by medical organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics. You know, just this morning, I checked my professional organization, their website, the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. And I went on there and looked at the advice that they are giving to parents about this issue. And they tell parents that they must immediately use their child's preferred name and pronouns. Now, this is extremely disturbing. We know that kids turn to their parents, well, to adults, but their parents in particular, to understand the world around them, to understand reality. And here, my professional organization and many others are informing, instructing parents to go ahead and rubber stamp this false identity, something that can never be true. Your son can never be your daughter, and you are doing no favor to your child to affirm that false identity, to lead them to believe that, yes, you were born in the wrong body. And so parents, teachers, everyone, and doctors as well, because doctors are terribly misinformed by their organizations, have to be educated. They have to learn, they have to listen, they have to ask questions, and most of all, understand that if they stick to the legacy medical organizations and the legacy news sites and our medical authorities, they are going to be very dangerously misinformed on this issue. So that's all I'm going to say right now. There's a ton of other things that we can go into, but I'm going to give other people a chance.
Well, and one big thing we're going to go into today is, what does the science actually look like? right? Like that supports everything that Dr. Grossman just talked about. You know, and in my excitement to get started, I'd like to actually introduce all of the remaining panelists, the three panelists. So we're going to have Chris Elston up next. That's Billboard Chris, of course. Some of you know him that way. He's a very prominent children's rights advocate. He's been traveling all around the world with a big sign that speaks to one of the things that Dr. Grossman mentioned right at the end about being born in the wrong body. I believe that's one of the signs that I've often seen on Chris wearing. And he's talked with thousands of people about this issue, just everyday people on the street. We're going to hear from you just next. But after that, we're going to have Kate Anderson, Senior Counsel and Director for the Center of Parental Rights at the Alliance for Defending Freedom. And so she's involved in a number of legal cases around all of these issues that we're talking today. And finally, to round it all out, we have Tiffany Justice. She's the co-founder of Moms for Liberty. This is a super fast growing network of grassroots activists advocating for parental rights. And I think also, in effect, children's rights across America. So, Chris, you're up next.
Thank you so much. I'm super pleased and honored to be part of this powerful panel here today. I just want to back up what Miriam Grossman said. There's no such thing as a transgender child. These are called girls and boys, and the positive message we should be sending is that they're beautiful just as they are. But the message that has become the dominant message throughout politics, throughout the left, through our schools, through all of these NGOs, is that somehow it's a progressive and loving and kind thing to tell a child that they're supposed to be something they're not. Because that's what this message is. Transgender ideology is about self-hatred. It's about teaching children that if they don't like their bodies, that they can change them and that that will find them true happiness. It's taking children who have invariably other mental health comorbidities, anxiety, depression, autism is extremely prevalent. Dr. Grossman had mentioned the gender identity service at the Tavistock in the United Kingdom. They conducted their own survey of their own patients, and out of more than 1,000 kids, 35% had moderate to severe autism. The former president of the American College of Pediatrics, Dr. Quentin Van Meter, who we all know from this panel, I've met with members of Congress with him, he told me he estimates 60% of these kids have suffered sexual abuse, and he's still a practicing physician, still teaching, still meeting with these kids. And when you read the stories of these detransitioners, sexual abuse is extremely common. For a girl who's been sexually abused, this is going to be the greatest trauma of her life. And if you give her an out where she can just say she's a boy and she can escape what she considers to be the source of her abuse, being female, well, of course, some kids are going to jump at this. And I've talked to young people on the street who told me how they were sexually abused and now they're transitioning. So there's always something else going on, but we don't treat these other conditions anymore. We just treat the child as though gender is the source of all their problems. And the practice, especially in North America, but throughout the West, is to simply affirm the child that they were born in the wrong body. Increasingly, safeguards have been eroded to the point where now on their first appointments, often kids are getting puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones, and they're scheduling appointments for double mastectomies over the phone when they're still children. So the whole thing is outrageous. We need to get back to the positive message that children are beautiful just as they are, and this entire ideology is based on a lie, and the whole thing needs to be torn up and thrown in the trash heap.
No, and one of the things I'll just mention to our viewers, one of the things I'd like to make sure that we talk about is this CAS report that came out in the UK, which, you know, looked at all these questions even deeper. This is following the Tavistock clinic being shut down. Kate, let's hear from you.
So my work at ADF has been largely focused on attacking this issue from the parental rights angle, really protecting parents under the law as they're trying to help their kids. And parents' rights matter because kids matter. And that's really where those rights come from. Parents have this duty to their kids to raise them, to direct their upbringing and education. And that's why parental rights matter. They step in to ensure that parents have the opportunity to do that. And we're seeing this fight come out so much on the gender identity issue. And the comments so far this morning have been wonderful, and they make me think so much of our clients, the real people who are struggling with this and dealing with this on the day to day. We have the opportunity to represent a mom and daughter with the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty who are struggling with this issue in Wisconsin. The daughter was middle school age. This was during COVID. She was dealing with a lot of anxiety, depression, body image issues. She began reading online and hearing at her school about how maybe if she was uncomfortable with her body, she was just born in the wrong body. And she began to believe that. When she took that issue to her parents, they began trying to find professional help to help her deal with everything that she was facing. And those professionals just told them that they needed to immediately jump to transitioning their daughter. They needed to use a male name, male pronouns, look into medical interventions that would have lifelong consequences for her. And these professionals even threatened them with the line that we so often hear in this context, that they can have a live son or a dead daughter. Well, fortunately, these parents started digging into what the professionals were saying, and they learned that the professionals weren't asking their daughter anything about the anxiety and depression she was facing. They had no advice on her body image issues or anything that didn't run in line with what's sometimes called gender-affirming care. And so these parents said, wait, we want to give this girl space. We love her. We want her to have the time to deal with everything she's facing, and we want her to have support in doing that. So they sort of froze everything, ended up having to pull her out of school because her school district said they would adopt a male name, male pronoun, even though her parents told them not to, which is a significant problem. But under school policy, the school was going to go ahead with pushing this girl through a social transition when her parents did not believe that was best for her. And it turned out it was not best for her. As you're hearing from these other panelists, it's not best for anyone. This girl had the opportunity because her parents gave her space to deal with her depression, her anxiety. She began to become comfortable in her own skin, and within a couple of months told her mother at the dining room table, you know, Mom, all of the affirmation that I received telling me that I should be a boy really messed me up. And that's what I think you hear now from so many of the kids that are getting on the other side of this. They need their parents. Parents are in the best possible position to know their kids best, to know everything their child is dealing with. And the vast majority of parents would do anything to protect their kids. So kids need their parents, and the government needs to get out of the way to allow parents to be there for their kids. The family is the unit that's supposed to raise kids. That's how we've always historically understood it. That's how our culture has operated. You see the truth of this when you see parents making decisions, helping their kids, raising their kids. And what's happening in the courts, in the schools across our country, is that government officials are getting in the way of allowing parents to fulfill their duty. And that's why this issue of parental rights has become so important. We have another similar case in Michigan involving a girl who was struggling with autism, and her school began socially transitioning her. Well, her parents, who were very involved parents, were actively speaking with school officials, working with them to try to address their daughter's issues, which at that time they believed were only autism, and found out that the school was lying to them this whole time. They were even changing their daughter's records before sending records home so that the parents would not know that the school was using a male name and pronoun for their daughter. That kind of lying is where we are with the schools. And it's really dangerous because kids struggling with these issues need their parents, and parents are the right ones to be here walking through these difficult challenges with them. And this idea that sort of, how did we get here? This idea that parents are the ones that have this important responsibility and then the rights that go along with it is why historically in the courts and the cases, the courts talked about parental rights as fundamental and protected by the Constitution. But as that's come along and our society has shifted so much away from respect and understanding of how important the family is, the law has switched too and began to shift. And you have courts that, especially in the education context, have not protected parents and their ability to protect their kids within the schools. So what we're seeing in the law is both a patchwork of protections where schools are protected at different, or parents are protected and kids are protected at different levels in different states, which is a significant problem, that you could be more protected in one state than another, as well as this idea coming out of education, that when you get into education, parents can choose public school, private school, or homeschooling, and that if they choose public school, and this is actually in some of the case law, then their rights end at the schoolhouse gate. And parents' rights do not end at the schoolhouse gate. So we need to fix this. We need to fix this in the law with important cases. We need to fix this through lawmakers coming together and passing laws that protect parents, and we need to do it through advocacy. And I think this panel illustrates that well. We need the medicine, we need the law, and we need the parents coming together to pull our society back to a place where we understand how important the role and the duties of parents are, and how important it is that the government stay out of the way so that parents can fulfill those duties. And parents standing up everywhere across the country is going to make this difference.
You know, one of the things I think we definitely want to try to cover is, you know, there's so many people that have been misinformed around this issue because of some, you know, very powerful organizations in some cases, you know, accepting, you know, these WPATH guidelines, right, which we've learned since aren't actually based on science. And so one of the things I want to make sure we cover, and I'm flagging this for my team as well in the background to remind us, that is, you know, if you're a parent who believes some of these things, because, you know, for example, you're the pediatric association that you followed, or the doctor following the, you know, guidelines from their pediatric association told you something, you know, and you, you know, went the wrong way on this, how do you come back from that? Because that could be very difficult, right? Anyway, we'll deal with that later. Finally, we have Tiffany Justice up. And Tiffany, you've been doing a ton of advocacy around this. I mean, this is, maybe I'll also get you to just briefly mention what Moms for Liberty does. But what are the key things that parents should know about gender ideology in schools? And what are sort of the key recommendations for parents in your mind?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me today, Jan. It's a tough act to follow with Kate Anderson, who just did a beautiful job really explaining how parents should be involved in every major decision in their children's lives. I was serving on a school board during COVID, and it really showed me that there was an expert class that thought that they knew better than parents. Nowhere do we see that more than the school system. Kate's right, your parental rights do not stop at the classroom door. And my biggest message to parents around this issue of gender ideology or gender affirming care or gender confusion is you need to parent this issue like you would parent any other issue that you are dealing with your child. If they're experiencing some type of mental distress, never do we affirm that mental distress. For example, anorexia. Never would we encourage our daughter to continue to starve herself or get them lap band surgery. But in this issue, it seems like parents have just been given horrible advice. You know, I have so much compassion for parents who think that they're doing what's best for their child, because you have groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, Jan, much like Miriam said about the associations that she belongs to, that are saying to parents that this idea of medical transition, social transition is good. And I think there's a lot of confusion. How did we get to this point? So I'll tell you, I was on a school board 2016 to 2020. And one of the things that we saw was that a lot of this idea of sexual orientation or gender ideology being brought into schools was coming through the back door. So it wasn't coming in front of the school board for votes. We weren't having community discussions about those things, because that's what you do when you have a school board, right? You have policies or different things you want to put into place, and you have meetings publicly to discuss those things so that the community members can have a say about them, so parents are aware of what's happening in their district. But that wasn't happening here. These support guides, as they're called, technical guidance, were coming up through the school system and student services department. And that was the point that we realized that there were secret documents that were being kept within the school system, and that there were counselors and others that were being encouraged to have private conversations between parents and children, with 6 pages of forms being filled out, asking the child questions like Kate said about, what name would you like for us to use at school with you? What name would you like for us to use when we talk to your parents? There were plans that would handle if there was a sibling at the school that wasn't aware of the gender transition. Where would you like to sleep on field trips when you go away on field trips? Which bathroom will you use at school? All kinds of decisions that children have absolutely no business making. You know, what we realized was that there was this undercurrent happening in the school districts where this ideology was being pushed up. Well, where do we find ourselves now in America? We find ourselves with new Title IX regulations that the Biden administration issued in April, which are supposed to go into effect on August 1st, that mean boys in your girls' locker rooms, boys on your girls' sports teams, and the government basically giving the rubber stamp to private conversations happening between children and adults, and your child being put on a path of social transition without your consent or knowledge. The school district would never do anything of that sort about any other issue. Why is this issue different? And so these are the types of questions that parents need to be asking. They need to understand that this has the guidance of the federal government. There are a number of lawsuits, I want to say upwards of 9 or 10 right now, against the Title IX regulations going into effect. So parents, please know that there are people like Kate and her teammate at ADF, Southeastern Legal Foundation, groups like Moms for Liberty. We have a federal lawsuit that to stop this from going into effect. But this is an ideology that is in all of our schools. And so parents, you need to be talking and having honest conversations with your kids, and you need to be talking to your kids' teachers. You need to be asking them, are you going to handle this issue of gender ideology in the classroom? How will it be handled if you discuss it? Can I opt my child out of that instruction? If my child expresses mental distress at school, what will you do? Will you contact me? You need to tell them you do not want private conversations happening with your child and other adults. You want to be present if that's happening. And so this is a real time for vigilance for parents as we kind of find our way through and we get to a point of the medical community in the United States really coming to consensus and understanding the real harms of gender affirming care. And I'm excited, Young, to talk about the CAS report, because the American Academy of Pediatrics and other medical groups have not answered for the evidence that we saw in the CAS report, which showed that there are increases in cancer and other things for children who are put on puberty blockers. And so I'll end with this. Parents, you need to trust yourself. You are the best decision maker for your children, and you should be involved in every major decision that is happening with them. Your parental rights do not stop at the classroom door. And so you need to not be pushed out, and you need to have your voice heard again in every major decision that's happening with your child at school.
Tiffany, thanks so much for that. So I'm going to ask a few questions of each panelist now, but before I do that, I just want to remind everyone that I'm just going to ask a few questions. But what we really want is for you in the audience who are listening to our frankly amazing panelists, I'm so happy to be here with you all, let's ask them your questions. So we're going to field those up shortly after we get through the few that I have. So this is what this is the question that I'd actually like to start with. And I think maybe this is something that we could field to Dr. Grossman. The original question I had in my mind was just, this question was raised about, you know, parents being told that if you don't affirm, your child will commit suicide. I've heard this come up many times. I've seen this has been mentioned in lawsuits. It's certainly mentioned in your book, Dr. Grossman. So I want to touch on that one, but the other question I want to make sure we touch on is this other question of if a parent has sort of gone down this road of these recommendations, right? And now they're realizing that something went wrong, how to deal with that. But let's start with the suicide question first.
Yeah, well, certainly it is, you could even call it a mantra at this point. It's repeated so many times. And many of the families coming to me in my office have heard this mantra, you know, do you want a dead daughter or a living son? It's just something, it's an emotional manipulation of the parents of the worst sort, because obviously parents are going to do anything to save the life of their child. And I'll add that these parents, I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of parents, and they have all been the most devoted and loving parents that you would ever want to see. These are parents that want the best for their child. Now, the claim that a child or teenager's mental health is going to deteriorate if they don't have these social and medical interventions is simply not substantiated. Over and over again, we have no evidence that that is the case. In fact, what we do see is that kids who are put on blockers and then opposite sex pronouns, often that's when their emotional deterioration begins in earnest. And I want to mention, you spoke about the CAS report. The CAS report is a bombshell, groundbreaking report that came out of the United Kingdom about 2 months ago. And it was commissioned by their National Health Service, in part due to this explosion and skyrocketing number of cases at their clinic in London, and compounded by the fact that they had a huge calamity at that clinic, in which I think it's 30 of their therapists resigned in opposition to what they were being told to do, which was place almost every child, regardless of age and regardless of comorbid psychiatric diagnoses, to place that child on the path toward medicalization, rapid medicalization, without delving into it, without looking at the family closely, without providing help for their anxiety and depression. It was just straight to the blockers and the hormones. And so at the Tavistock Clinic, they had this calamity scandal that occurred. Excellent books have been written about it. And as a result, the National Health Service asked Dr. Hilary Cass, a prominent pediatrician in England, to review all the data and to come up with recommendations. Now, her report took 4 years. She didn't do it alone. She had an entire team from York University helping her. And it took 4 years, and her report is almost 400 pages long. So this is not a joke. This is the most comprehensive review of gender-affirming care ever done in history. And there's a lot of important conclusions and recommendations that she made. But just to get, Jan, into the question that you just asked me regarding suicide, there was no evidence of increased suicides in this group. Yes, they have an slightly elevated risk of suicide compared to the general population of kids. But when you compare them to the population of kids who have comorbid psychiatric issues, autism, ADHD, depression, anxiety, trauma, et cetera, they do not have an increased risk of suicide. And there is no evidence whatsoever that these medical and surgical interventions will prevent any suicides. It is irresponsible to put out that information, which we are hearing over and over and over again. Dr. Rachel Levine, you know, number two at Health and Human Services, seems like at every opportunity, Dr. Levine is spouting this falsehood. So there's a lot more that could be said about this myth of suicidality, but I'll tell you honestly, I'm concerned about suicide in two other groups. I'm concerned about suicide in the young people who later on, after months or usually years, recognize their mistake. And they recognize it after they've already been permanently disfigured and possibly sterilized. I'm worried about their suicidal ideation, and I'm worried about parents. The parents that have to deal with this most horrific, hellish situation in their home of being faced with either denying reality or losing your child, having your child turn around and become estranged from you. That is what's happening now. Or having Child Protective Services, we didn't talk about that yet, swoop in and take your child away on the basis of they're calling parents who will not socially affirm with pronouns and new names, they're calling that emotional abuse. The parents that will refuse to sign on the dotted line for hormones, they're calling that medical neglect. Families are being destroyed by this ideology. And that is one of the reasons I wrote my book. It's called Lost in Transnation. Parents need to be well educated on this subject before their kid comes home distressed and confused and believing that they're born in the wrong body. Way before that, years before that. So I'll stop. I could go on for hours, but I'm going to stop because I know other people have a lot to say.
Yeah, and I think Chris wanted to jump in and with a quick follow-up here. And I just, the one thing I want to just mention again, as you were talking, Dr. Grossman, you know, it just struck me that, you know, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of victims in this, right? Yeah. And so we've got the parents, we've got these kids. And, you know, when people, you know, this is obviously a society, I don't know what the right word is, but a society morphing, a society, a very destructive issue for society. But we kind of have to give people sort of ways to come back from it, right? And I want to make sure that we cover that very seriously during the talk here. But Chris, why don't you jump in?
Thank you very much. So what's the only way you can justify what we're doing to kids? What's the only possible way you can justify stopping puberty in a child, giving them the opposite sex's hormones, which are causing cancer, which are causing girls to have to get hysterectomies and oophorectomies where they cut out their ovaries? This ideology is causing children as young as 12 years old, this has happened in California, to even get double mastectomies. So how do you justify any of this child abuse? You say kids are going to kill themselves if we don't do it. And the leftists, the activists who push this, say it in every single conversation. And I'm not exaggerating, because I've had 20 or 30,000 of these conversations on the street. And it's the number one thing I hear every time. Kids are going to kill themselves if we don't transition them. Followed closely by the other myth, which is that puberty blockers are reversible. Totally untrue. We can get to that later. But finally, just this year, a few months ago, out of Finland, we had the first proper study that had ever been done into childhood suicides. And they looked at more than 2,000 children who went to the gender clinic in Finland over 23 years, from 1996 to 2019. They compared it to a control group of more than 17,000 kids. Over those 23 years at the gender clinic, and keep in mind, most of these kids, particularly for the first two-thirds of this trial period, most of these kids weren't getting puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones because they weren't doing this in the 90s. This is a newer phenomenon. But out of those 23 years, more than 2,000 kids, there were only 7 suicides. And of course, every suicide is a tragedy. But this isn't some epidemic of suicides. The suicide rate, when they compared it to the control group, was similar to kids in the control group, exactly as Dr. Grossman just said. It was similar to kids who also had other mental health issues going on, and to kids who had autism, to kids who had bad family lives, depression, whatever, eating disorders. It was very similar. So it wasn't gender that was the cause of the suicidality. It was other things. But this is the one way that they have been able to gain so much ground in pushing this, because you get all these young people in particular who have come out of high school and university who have been told these lies nonstop. And so then they see someone like me wearing a sign saying children cannot consent to puberty blockers, and they think I'm some devil because kids are going to kill themselves if we don't transition them. How utterly insane. We've been around on this planet for a few hundred thousand years as a species. Kids weren't killing themselves because they were going through puberty. Yes, it can be a hard time. Yes, we need to help these children. But this is just a terribly vicious lie to support this ideology. And I just wanted to add one more thing, also backing up what Dr. Grossman just said. This is from the summary of the CAS report that was done in the UK. One of the summary's findings was that clinicians are unable to determine with any certainty which children and young people will go on to have an enduring trans identity. 2 years ago in France, the Academy of Medicine came out with these exact same findings. They have no idea which kids will outgrow their quote unquote gender dysphoria and which ones will not. And when we look at all of the academic studies that were done into gender dysphoria before we started giving kids puberty blockers, which really started around the turn of the century and grew towards 2010, really took off around 2015. But when we look at all the academic studies that were done before this, the most recent one finished in 2004. It was done by Bradley Singh and Kenneth Zucker. You'll find it on my website, billboardchris.com. But they followed 139 boys, because it did used to affect boys way more than girls. Now that's completely flipped. But even then, it was like 1 out of 30,000 kids. But they followed 139 boys from when they were 4 or 5 years old all the way into their 20s. 87.8% of these boys simply outgrew their gender dysphoria. It went away. It desisted. They grew up. and 63.6% grew up to be gay. And when you look at all the academic studies, we see these similar findings before this current craze took off. So most grow out of it. A lot of them grow up to be gay, which we haven't touched on yet in this. But this is the actual conversion therapy going on in the world. We have all these conversion therapy bills banning conversion therapy of someone's sexual orientation and then gender identity as though these are the same things. But what's really going on is that young people who would grow up to be gay are being told there's something wrong with them and they need to change their bodies. So the whole thing's a mess.
I mean, they're very, very difficult things to wander through. And Chris, you mentioned you had spoken to 20 or 30,000 people. Just quickly for the record, how long have you been out there with your billboard now, and how many cities?
I started my campaign in September of 2020, and I've been to 7 countries, I think probably 80 different cities or something like that. I go to a lot of university campuses. I go to downtown centers where it's extremely busy. And I get more than 90% support from the broad public. The people who don't like me can't really have a conversation. And they can't define what gender identity means, which I think is very interesting. They can't define what it means to be transgender. They can't define what it means for a girl to be a boy. Ultimately, it just comes down to stereotypes. I had a woman tell me once, well, you know, girls like, you know, nail polish and long hair and the color pink. I said, okay, so if a boy likes nail polish, does that make him a girl? Well, of course not. They know how ridiculous that is. Every single activist out there knows that's ridiculous. So then they try to change their story, but they can never define what it means. And that's one reason this ideology has had so much success, because it confuses people. They use terms which ultimately have no meaning. And everyone's confused. And this became the new gay rights movement. But it's nothing of the sort. We need to separate the LGB from the TQ. When gay rights were won, all the objectives and the goals for all of these nonprofits turned to trans rights. And basically, they've been successful in turning what is a mental illness into a civil rights movement that we're not supposed to question. But when children are coming to harm, of course we should be talking about it. Of course we should be questioning it. And all the evidence points, of course, to there being nothing wrong with these children. We don't need to try to do childhood sex changes. We should be telling them they're beautiful just as they are.
Now, this is
Can I add a point in there?
Oh, go ahead.
Matt, just had a quick point. Just that we're seeing, I'm just having a lot of hope on this issue right now, because like Dr. Grossman was talking about, like Chris was talking about, there's medical information getting in now, starting in Europe and now flowing into the United States, where good quality medical information about gender identity issues are coming in, and parents can get actual information. So I just encourage parents to be informed about this issue, to have courage that you know your child best, no matter what a professional is telling you. Get good advice on this issue, because parents need, or kids need their parents to come alongside them on this. And the court cases are starting to come the right way too. We were able to win that case in Wisconsin and have a court come in and say what the school district did in trying to socially transition a girl without her parents' permission and against their direct instruction not to do so violated their constitutional rights under state law, and that parents are the ones that are supposed to be making these decisions. We've also seen a number of cases recently from teachers who are stuck in the middle on this, saying that they're being required to socially transition kids and they can't do that in good conscience. And the court's coming in not only protecting those teachers, but saying things in those cases about how important it is for parents to be making these decisions, to be getting the information and be the ones directing their kids on this issue. And I think if parents can have that courage to get the information and do what they know is best for their kids, this is going to save so many children.
You know, Kate, this is actually a perfect segue. I was about to ask you this question, but this is sort of the perfect moment to do so. You know, you're basically been making the argument that parental rights are critical. They're basically being kind of subverted a bit. I want to talk a little bit about what parental rights really mean, where they come from. There, you know, you could very much imagine a reality, right, where a parent has, basically learned a lot of the gender ideology, saw some things in their kid and say, well, it's my parental right to help my kid transition because I believe that's right. And Kate, how dare you basically try to subvert my parental rights after the speech you just gave? So I just want to speak to that a little bit, if you could, please.
Well, parental rights come ultimately from the duty that parents have to raise their kids and direct their upbringing, to educate them, to help them form into citizens. And so the Constitution protects parental rights. It does so, and the courts have recognized it as a fundamental right protected by the Constitution, because there's been this historic understanding of the role of the family and the role of parents. And it's so much tied into the duty of those parents to protect their kids and to raise their kids. So I think that informs the discussion on this issue as well. Parents have the right to direct their kids' education and their healthcare because they have that responsibility to do what's best for their kids. And when that breaks down, they don't have the right to do something that's going to harm their kid. And so you see so many states coming in. There are cases in Alabama, in Tennessee, other cases around the country where Idaho, where the state has come in and seen the research coming out on gender ideology, the CAS reports, other things, and said, we're going to ban this dangerous and experimental intervention on children. And some activist groups have come in and said, well, that violates parental rights because parents should have the opportunity to choose this kind of intervention for their child. It's not a parental rights issue there because the states have the responsibility to regulate healthcare, to make sure that it is safe. And a parental right does not mean that a parent can force a state to provide something that is dangerous, experimental, illegal. In other contexts, parents aren't allowed to make the state make available to their child something that's illegal. So it wouldn't do so here. And so you see that movement, kind of the push and pull on parental rights. But at the end of the day, parental rights are sort of two sides of the same coin, that duty and that responsibility. So when parents are fulfilling their duty, they have the right to have their government get out of the way so that they can fully care for their kid in the best way possible.
Well, and again, that the huge challenge here is that there's many parents, I believe, even today, maybe even watching this, that at least up to now, have deeply believed that this is the right thing to do because everyone around them has been telling them to do that, right?
So, yeah, and I feel so much for those parents because that has been the push in the medical field to push parents. There are parents in Wisconsin that were told your daughter's going to kill herself if she doesn't get this intervention. And yet now that information is coming out from Europe into the United States, the studies that are coming out, the CAS report, that are really helping parents see the truth on this issue.
Well, Tiffany, we've been talking a lot about educating parents, why don't we actually start there? This is something, you have built together with Tina Deskovich and frankly, a whole ever-growing network of moms around America, and I think actually beyond even a little bit. Actually, that's another reminder. We do have quite a number of viewers from Canada, and I want to talk a little bit about the Canadian reality before we finish today, too. But tell a little bit about what Moms for Liberty is, what you do, but also what are some of these, how can a parent the quickest way possible get up to speed with these realities? And where's the information that can really be trusted?
So thank you for that, Jan. You're right. Moms for Liberty is a growing network of moms and dads and community members around the United States that are very concerned about how our kids are doing. And they're not doing well. Only a third of kids are reading on grade level. But as we discussed before, this toxic gender ideology is being pushed into our schools now with the rubber stamp of the federal government. And so, moms and dads coming together, there's our website. So we have over 130,000 members in 48 states. Wherever you see a little yellow square, that's a county, just amazing. Over 315 chapters of really brave Americans. Our mission statement is to unify, educate, and empower parents to defend their parental rights at all levels of government. We truly believe that if parents understood, as Kate said, their duty, their responsibility, and the fact that the government needs to get out of the way of them raising their kids, that COVID wouldn't have happened in the way that it did. Parents would have stood up and said, no, government, you can't do this to us. You don't get to dictate how we raise our kids. And so we will never again allow what happened during COVID of our children being put on the back burner in America to happen again. And on this issue, parents are not being given accurate information. Parents deserve accurate information so they can make the very best decision for their child, whether that's the real harms of so-called gender-affirming care or the fact that 0% of kids are reading on grade level at their kid's school. They deserve to know that information so they can make the best decisions for what is right for their child in that moment. Chris has said to me from the time that I met him, and you mentioned Canada, and I hope he'll talk a little bit about what was happening in Canada when we met on Twitter, of all places, in a Twitter space. But I heard what was happening in Canada, and I always joke, I had this moment, I thought, okay, we have a very long border with Canada, and certainly this was happening in America. And then we have just seen since the time of COVID, the education curtain and the curtain on everything happening to kids just being pulled back. And so it's given us this amazing opportunity, honestly, we call it COVID lemonade at Moms for Liberty, to address these issues that are really harming our kids and our families and our country. But I found out what was happening in Canada, and then I learned more, and Chris gave me things to learn, and I followed Dr. Grossman and others who are doing work in this field. And Chris has said from the beginning, it's not that people are unwilling to talk about this issue. It's oftentimes that they don't know the right way to talk about this issue. And that, so we've learned a lot from Chris about his terminology, saying no child is born in the wrong body. There's no right way to be a boy or a girl. Just because a boy likes Barbies or a girl likes to play football doesn't mean that they were born in the wrong body. And these are very simple, common sense things that we should be sharing with people. I tell people all the time, I want you talking about this everywhere. These should be the nicest, kindest things to say, but talk about it at the dry cleaner, in the school pickup line, at the playground, at your work, right? But that's what we found at Moms for Liberty. So our mission statement, unify, bring people together, educate them on the issues so they have the real facts so they can engage in conversation, and then they feel empowered to make change happen. You ask about resources. I recommend that everyone go to Dr. Grossman's webpage and check out the information that she has there and the book that she wrote, Lost in Transnation. It's a wonderful book, as you said, Jan, and really helpful for parents. You should go to Chris's website and check out all of the different information that he's compiled. And ADF has some great tools and resources and kits for educators, for parents that are going through some of these things. The other thing that I would say, if you're watching this and you're just curious, I really don't know about gender ideology or gender affirming care, or I'm hearing President Biden talking about it all the time as the civil rights issue of our generation, but gosh, cutting off the healthy body parts of kids doesn't sound very good. What could this be about? There's a new toolkit. So you can go to gendertoolkit.com. And there's a group called Restore Childhood that came together during COVID because they recognize parents wanted information for their kids. They wanted to be able to make good decisions, but it seemed like the information was constantly biased and slanted, and they didn't know who they could trust. And so Restored Childhood came together and put something together called the Urgency of Normal Toolkit, where they really fought to get masks off of kids and to let kids lead healthy lives during COVID. There's the gender toolkit right there, gendertoolkit.com. It's called An Urgent Conversation. And that's really what we want to have. The truth of gender ideology and gender affirming care is that it's nonsense and that it's not what's best for kids. And the sooner that we can have this conversation with as many people as possible, sharing the information that Miriam has shared, that Kate has shared, that Chris has shared today, the sooner that we're going to beat this toxic ideology back, because kids deserve to learn to read in school. And right now we have kindergartners in America that are being taught that they might have been in the wrong body. They might have been born, in the wrong body, and that's unacceptable. And the government doesn't have the right to teach lies in school. We need to rely on our education system to unfold the full potential of every child and teach facts. And that's what Moms for Liberty is very focused on making sure we do.
Yeah, and so I actually just downloaded the Gender Toolkit last night. It's actually kind of a remarkable resource because it's not very long, but it packs a lot of punch in a very small, beautifully illustrated. And I think, they're going to want to get your email, where to send it to. I'd encourage you to do so. This is some people don't like giving their email. This is a trustworthy group. And I would love to actually hear back from you if you're watching what you think of this toolkit. So I think this is the time that I want to jump to audience questions, but there are a couple of outstanding questions just in my mind that I want to cover. So maybe I'm gonna go back on that for a moment. So the first question, and I'll let whoever wants to jump in to field this first, okay? If there is a parent who's watching, who's gone down the path of affirming their children, and they've been conflicted in that, or maybe they had one of their parents in that kind of mental frame, they're changing. It's just such a difficult reality, right? And the thing is that I think it's even very difficult for some people, maybe to even might be a difficult for them, pardon me, to to admit to themselves, like what exactly has happened? Because it's such a I guess big intervention, right? But so how do you, I'm sure that all of you have encountered this, and how can you help someone that it kind of, you know, go through the process of well, one, kind of educating themselves, and two, kind of getting to the other side, I guess.
I'll take this briefly, if I may. To be honest, Jan, these are very difficult people to reach. I view much of gender ideology to be like a cult. So essentially what you're talking about doing is deprogramming. And that's a very difficult thing to do when people have transitioned to their own child, especially if they've been enthusiastic about it. They're not reachable right now. And it might take them years to come around to understand what they've done, if they ever do. I think what we really need to do is reach the people in the middle of the spectrum, middle of the political spectrum. People from left and right all agree that, yeah, there's no such thing as a child born wrong. And we just need to keep getting the truth out there, because you really only need to reach 3 or 4% of the population before this whole thing comes crashing down. But my strategy with people who are pro-transition is to say things they agree with and to ask them questions. So if I say, first of all, there's no right way to be a girl or a boy, we shouldn't put them in some stereotypical box. If a girl's more masculine, if a boy's more feminine, beautiful, what's wrong with that? They get very confused because they automatically assume that I'm going to be against gender nonconformity, which I'm not. And so you've just said something that they agree with, and it causes this confusion, this cognitive dissonance, where there's now two competing ideas going on in their brain, and they're going to have to go home and ask themselves some questions and maybe start figuring this out. But the other thing to do is to ask questions. Ask them to define these terms. What does it mean for a girl to be a boy? You say your child is trans. Well, what does that mean? So your boy likes girly things? Well, that's okay. Why would you possibly ever change a child's body just because they have interests that are stereotypically associated with the opposite sex? That's nuts. But another facet of this is parents who themselves have mental illness. An older study showed that 52% of the moms of these boys with gender dysphoria themselves had borderline personality disorder. So I just think it's important to reach the people in the middle of the political spectrum. We need to reach the normies and educate them about this, and the whole thing will come crashing down, as it already is.
Could I just say a word on this? So Jan, you've asked, what about a parent who is wondering if perhaps it's more complicated than they thought? Perhaps they've made some mistakes along the road. So I would say to a parent like that, that they should understand that the same doubts that they have, the child also has. One of the reasons that these kids have to appear so sure and so certain and so, you know, 100% is because they can't face the possibility that they're wrong. And they've been told, they've been indoctrinated to believe that this is the solution to their emotional problems. And if they, for one moment, start to doubt that, then, I mean, oh my gosh, what is going to be the solution? They're hanging all their hopes on this one path, that living as the opposite sex is going to help all their problems, all their emotional issues, all their social issues, because they've been led to think that. And so they're hanging on to that. And when the parent approaches them with some uncertainty and sort of we need to be cautious, we need to be careful, that's when the kid, and I've seen this so many times in my practice, the kid freaks out because they can't handle that uncertainty. And a lot of these kids, as has been said by so many of you, are on the autism spectrum. And so the way that they think is very black and white. If I'm not comfortable as a girl and I don't like getting my periods and I don't like being looked at by men in a sexual way, I must be a boy, black or white. And so they have so much trouble with the gray. But truly, most of life is gray and not black and white. And that's what we need to help kids and parents navigate, is that gray zone, that zone of let's look into this, let's be careful, let's explore this. Let's look at the pros and cons. And I very much want to support any parent that is wise and courageous enough to question their past decisions. And they really should get a pat on the back, a lot of support. And by the way, there's so much support for parents out there right now. That wasn't the case a few years ago. But there are grassroots organizations, amazing groups of amazing parents who are there to support each other. And there's a list of those groups on my website as well. So that's the way that I would answer the question, that the uncertainty is painful and the uncertainty is anxiety provoking, but with support, we do want parents and kids to face that uncertainty, and then slowly, slowly, there is hope that they can get out of it.
And no. I see that in our real cases. We've had clients who took their kids to clinics where they were getting affirming care and realized as they started to learn what was going on there and how it was impacting their kid, pulled them back from that. And one mom in particular has talked to me about how angry her daughter was at her for a period of time. And she had to face that her daughter was going to be very, very angry with her for a period of time. But as she gave her daughter the space to work through everything, they began to be able to deal with the other things that that clinic was not dealing with, the anxiety and the depression that this girl was feeling. And this girl now, talking to her, she's become an advocate for that slowing down and watchful waiting and giving kids a chance and not pushing them through, because she said that all of those people in her life that were pushing her to transition were also driving a wedge between her and her parents and telling her that her parents were going to be the reason that she became very depressed, that she became even suicidal. And that was scary. But she got to a point where she realized that her parents were the only ones actually advocating for her and wanting to help her figure out all of the mental health issues that she was facing. And she now has this amazingly strong relationship with her parents and is a healthy, happy 16-year-old girl.
Incredible. You reminded me just now of there's a couple of groups that I have learned a lot from that have been trying to do this at a very evidence-based level to understand what's happening. One is Parents with Inconvenient Truths About Trans, PIT, P-I-T-T Parents. Another one is GenSpect. But in the PIT Parents wrote a book of something like 60 essays from parents who have actually faced this issue. And one of those essays, that's probably one of the most heart-wrenching, powerful things I've ever read, is a parent who precisely participated sort of enthusiastically in the transition of her child, realized things went wrong and, you know, had to face herself, had to face her kid and move forward to some sort of resolution. And it's, of course, incredibly difficult, but people can do it, right? And of course, whatever stage it's at, it makes some sense that this is something they seriously think about. So with that, the one final question I do want to ask is, if you're a parent and you're sitting down at your kitchen table or wherever, actually, maybe, you know, you don't get that much time with your kids and your kid tells you, well, I actually have a new name and here are my new pronouns. What is the next step here? And I'll whoever wants to jump in, please jump in.
Well, I guess I'll jump in. I mean, I have in my book, I have a model conversation, exactly that conversation. How do you respond? What do you say when your child comes to you with this announcement? So first of all, I would say to be prepared, if at all possible, to be aware that this might be a possibility in your family and to become knowledgeable about what is the proper response. You don't want to, you know, have an intensely emotional response. You want to try and keep your emotions in control. You can always start screaming later on. You don't want to do that in front of your child. You want to be there for your child and to be curious. Let your child do most of the talking. be curious. Oh, what does that mean? When did you start feeling that way? Where did you hear about this? Questions, just curiosity, loving them, but not agreeing with them. Acknowledging their emotions, because emotions are never wrong. So you can validate their feelings of confusion or anger or whatever it is, but you don't validate the beliefs. There's a big difference there. So you can be validating your child's emotional condition, but you're not validating their false beliefs. So you love them without affirming them. And you do not agree to the new names and pronouns. And you do not agree to the breast binder, which we haven't talked about, but most people do know that these are items that dangerous things that girls will wear to basically smash their breasts for hours and hours a day. So you do not agree to all of that. But what you do is you immediately try to find out who is your child talking to at school, online, everywhere. What is happening? Is she hearing about this from kids at school, from a guidance counselor? Does she belong to a club that you don't know about at school that, you know, during lunchtime? Is she going in and being indoctrinated there? You have to get your child off the internet. Now, that's not always 100% possible, but you must get in control of your child's internet use. And again, in my book, I have an appendix instructing parents on how to do that. Now, trust me, the internet is filled with people that are just waiting for your child to go onto a site, play a game, what have you. There's many, many places where groomers can meet up with your child and influence them. You cannot be too vigilant. I have so many stories of kids who have been brought into this cult, and I agree with Chris. There are many cult-like aspects to gender ideology, and it has happened through the internet. So no social media, no gay straight alliance meetings, no gender clinics, that's for sure. And I would say not even any smartphones. I would caution parents against giving their kids a smartphone. Be vigilant. If you don't think it's happening in your area, you're wrong, because it is. You can, at your dinner table or even whatever, with your young children, you can reinforce the idea that there's no one way to be a boy or a girl, and that however your child is wonderful, and they don't have to fit the stereotype. They do need to understand, though, that they have been a boy or a girl from the moment that they were created. From the earliest moment when they were as big as a speck of dust in their mommy, they were either a boy or a girl, and that will never change.
You know, I'm going to do a follow-up here quickly from Total Immersion English is the user. I have asked my daughter, almost 20, to go see a counselor to try to find the root cause of all this, but she will only see one who is a pro-trans and affirms her. Any ideas?
I'm going to repeat the words of Stella O'Malley, who is a therapist from Ireland and who founded GenSpect. And what she said at a conference that most of us attended in Washington, D.C. back in January of this year, is that oftentimes it's the parents who need the coaching from the counselors or the therapists, not the kids. What you're doing when you send a child to a therapist is you're getting that child to go into their own head, when oftentimes I would say they just need to go outside and play. They need to get off social media. They need to get out of their video games. They need to get away from any influence, and they need to go play and do what we've evolved to do as human beings, which is play with other kids outside. And it's the parents who need help in navigating this. So maybe Dr. Grossman wants to disagree with me, but I think in most of these cases, therapy could possibly be a worse thing for the child because it just gets them deeper into their own head.
I'll just mention that it's a 20-year-old we're talking about here.
Wait, were you finished, Chris? Can I say
something? Yeah.
Okay, given that it is a 20-year-old, what I would tell this mother or total immersion English, first of all, is to endorse your 20-year-old daughter for being willing to go to therapy. You know, that's good. However, the therapy that it sounds like she is chosen is not the kind of therapy that you feel is going to be helpful. I would certainly not pay for such therapy, for affirming therapy. I would, you know, continue to support your daughter in wanting to seek help, but try to find somebody who, and there are groups right now, there are many therapists that do not automatically affirm and that do what we call, you know, exploratory therapy. You know, and I would encourage her to try try and meet with some of those people and see if she could find someone there, and that you would pay for that. I would certainly not support financially or otherwise an affirming therapist. That's not what you want. That's going to be just the rubber stamping, the gender affirming care, you know, the supporting your daughter and her if she wants, you know, surgeries and all of that. So you don't want her to go down that path.
Can I jump in for a second, Jan? I just have a follow-up. You're talking about a 20-year-old. Some of the most convincing and stories, and some of the stories that have touched me the most, are from detransitioners, from these beautiful girls that have made different decisions. You know, I often say that these gender ideologues steal a future from these girls that they don't even know that they want, but at some point are going to desperately crave, and that's motherhood. I remember listening to Chloe Cole speak on a stage and talk about the fact that, you know, she never will be, she doesn't know if she'll be able to have children. She certainly won't be able to breastfeed her children. She had both of her breasts removed at the age of 15. And then she talked about how her wounds were still weeping. And in that moment, I looked around that room and I just thought to myself, so much pressure and the government funding these surgeries in so many ways. And yet here you have someone on the other side of it that is suffering the harms and there is no help for them. There is no support. There is no funding. And so what I would say to this parent of the 20-year-old would be, start exposing your kid, and there'll always be your kid, I don't care how old they are, right? Start exposing your child to some of the other stories that are out there from some of the people that have gone through this, and see if those stories maybe will help to influence their decision-making as well.
Okay, so this one should be simple, or maybe not. Kristen D. Smith, 2. Does anyone know when the use of puberty blockers actually began?
Well, puberty blockers have been used for a long, long time to treat an altogether different condition, a medical condition in kids called precocious puberty, in which kids at the age of 6 or 7, for some reason, their brains start producing hormones that tells their body to start to mature. And so puberty blockers were used for those kids in order to delay puberty to a normal time. But I'm told actually by an endocrinologist that that's not even being done these days anyway. So the answer to that question is that it's been used for a long time with kids who have a medical condition, a bona fide, you know, pathology that's going on in their bodies. But in terms of using puberty blockers for normal, physically healthy kids, that started as an experiment in the Netherlands in the 90s on very, very few kids, because as has been mentioned before, this condition was so incredibly rare in the 90s and in the even the 2000s that the studies have incredibly few subjects because there just weren't that many and they were mostly boys. But to answer the question, these puberty blockers were started, but at a later age. They were started in the Dutch study at the age of 14 or older. Now we're starting puberty blockers, according to gender-affirming care, at the very first sign of puberty, which in some kids can be 8 or 9 years old. And that's not precocious puberty. That's normal puberty. Kids are going into puberty very early these days. And so gender-affirming care calls for these blockers to be given at the first sign of puberty, which is called Tanner stage 2. And when that is done, and in most of these kids, almost 100% of them, go on to then take cross-sex hormones, they are guaranteed to be sterile. Their eggs and sperm are never given a chance to mature. So that is one of the many dangers of puberty blockers. There's a long list of them. But just to answer the question, we have never until quite recently given these puberty blockers to physically healthy kids. And there is no evidence. And let me just say this. You see, when we block normal puberty, we are preventing the biological process that in most kids is going to be the cure for their dysphoria. Mm. If we allow these kids to go through normal puberty and reach young adulthood, like has been already said, the vast majority of them will be at peace with their bodies. Many of them are gay or lesbian, but they are fertile and they are healthy and they have not gone down the path of being a permanent consumer of pharmaceuticals, which is what happens to these kids.
That's right. I just want to add, if for anyone who wants to learn about the origin of this, you can look up what's called the Dutch protocol. And as Dr. Grossman said, this started in the mid 90s, but even then they had more safeguards in place. They were ruling out kids with other mental health comorbidities. They weren't giving cross-sex hormones until they were 16. When this was imported into the United States, the first gender clinic, I think, was Boston in 2007. Over time, they've basically eliminated all these safeguards to the point today where they say the kids shouldn't even get therapy. Apparently, it's insulting to say that these kids should get therapy because that would be invalidating their gender identity as though there's something wrong with a girl identifying as a boy. So the whole thing's just gone completely off the rails, and we've had activists telling medical organizations how to do their job.
You know, and I can't help but think about Stella O'Malley, who was mentioned earlier, one of the founders of GenSpect. You know, she actually powerful testimonial in American Thought Leaders, if you go back a few episodes. But she really deeply wanted to be a boy for the longest time, even after puberty. And today, you know, she says that one of the most important things she's ever done is become a mom. And just at some point in her life, that switch flipped and she would have never known if, you know, basically she had grown up in this kind of an environment. So this is the other thing that actually, you know, strikes me. Like kid, in those young ages, you don't really know what you're actually getting into. You can't even imagine when we're mostly talking about girls today, you know, that at some point you're really going to want to be a mom and you want to be able to do it, right?
Yeah, what child can possibly make the decision as to whether or not they want to be a mom when they're 13, 14, 15 years old? And I just want to make this point because I think it's important for people to understand what's happening with the federal government. Right now, there is a man who thinks he is a woman. His name is Richard Levine. He goes by Rachel Levine. He's the Assistant Secretary of Health and Human Services. And we've just found out that he has advocated for removing and lowering the ages of gender transition across the United States of America. This is an activist that is giving horrible advice and information. But again, a seat at the table with the federal government pushing this ideology. I don't know if there are other panelists that want to discuss that a bit, but it's important for people to understand. The last thing I'll say about that is this. Dr. Levine is on the record for saying that he is so happy he didn't transition until he became older because he was able to be a father. And so just the stake in the heart that for me as a mom, the fact that he would recognize the beauty and the joy of being a parent, but would be willing to steal that away from so many children is completely unacceptable.
Yeah, just this week it was revealed that in September of 2022, Richard Rachel Levine, he pressured the World Professional Association for Transgender Health. They were releasing the 8th version of their standards of care, which children's hospitals can follow. They claim to follow. They don't need to follow them. These are just guidelines. But he pressured WPATH to remove all minimum age requirements. And I remember this because I'd caused a massive storm of controversy with these videos I'd tweeted out from Boston Children's Hospital's own YouTube channel. They deleted all of their own videos, but I recorded them, tweeted them out. Libs of TikTok, Matt Walsh retweeted them, and they went extremely viral. But in September of 22, they released their guidelines and then one day later removed all the age requirements. And one of the reasons that has just been revealed, which we speculated at the time, was because they want to protect themselves legally. Because if their guidelines say you should only do mastectomies on 15-year-old girls, but then they're doing mastectomies on 13-year-old girls, well, that opens them up for lawsuits, doesn't it? And so now you've got the assistant health secretary, a man who was so happy he had his own family before he transitioned, advocating to remove all age requirements so that more kids can get sterilized. And what we haven't even mentioned is that the president of WPATH, a man who says he's a woman, a man named Marcy Bowers, he admits in a Zoom call that I've tweeted out many times, none of the boys who started puberty blockers at Tanner Stage 2 have been able to have an orgasm as an adult. So what 10 or 11-year-old boy can possibly consent to that when they don't even understand what it means? This whole thing is insane child abuse.
Of course, this is all correct, and I'm so glad this is all coming out in our discussion. Let me also say that as of yesterday, there is a petition for Dr. Levine's resignation. It's being done through an incredible organization called DoNoHarmMedicine.org. I do happen to be a senior fellow there. Please, everyone listening, I hope that you would agree that Dr. Levine must resign. It is unacceptable. And again, Dr. Levine is a pediatrician, mind you, and is on the record saying that he is so happy that he didn't transition until he had children. And he says, I can't imagine life without my children. Now, can you imagine? And here he is standing up time and time again and advocating for these kids to be sterilized. It's just nauseating.
And if I may, just in the legal realm, what we're seeing are a movement from people who are detransitioning to file medical malpractice lawsuits. And those are getting significant traction. Where doctors and gender clinics are being held responsible for what they've done to kids who are now living with the lifelong consequences of that. So Tiffany mentioned hearing their stories, but there are cases that are coming alongside them. And when you follow the money, that makes a big difference on the availability of these things and how much doctors are willing to push it if they may be facing lawsuits.
Okay. Let's get a few more questions in. I see our clock is running very fast here. Is the user. Our Michigan school is rewriting their Title IX policy based on new mandates, which our super says are tied to federal funding. Our state isn't part of lawsuits. Can schools legally refuse?
Yes.
Kate.
Yes, and they should. Title IX has certainly made sweeping changes in adopting gender identity as the definer. So they're blurring the lines between men and women and boys and girls in schools. That's going to affect private spaces and all kinds of things. What Title IX did not do is explicitly say that they need to change their secret social transition policies, essentially, that schools have to start pushing kids towards transition. But it did set the stage for that to happen with the redefinition of Title IX to apply to gender identity. So what we're seeing in schools, and what you're probably seeing in Michigan, is that schools are taking Title IX as an excuse to push forward more aggressive policies on gender identity and ideology. So they're pushing policies that require teachers to socially transition kids, They're doing all of the forms that Tiffany talked about, asking kids what they want to be called, whether they want their parents to know. And of course, when you ask a child, you know, your parent doesn't need to know. Do you want me to tell your parent? What do you think the child's going to say? And putting them into locker rooms and bathrooms with the opposite sex. And so we're seeing a spread of those policies. We were seeing a spread of those kinds of policies ahead of Title IX. Title IX is certainly encouraging more of that.
And yeah, and I'll just say, if you go to the Moms for Liberty website, we have a pop-up. It'll say Title IX resources. There are tools there for you to understand more about Title IX, what the regulations are, what they propose, when they're supposed to go into effect. You'll see a number of lawsuits that have been filed, and you can read through those lawsuits. You'll see the recommendations that superintendents are giving to their school districts in different states when they've taken a stand. And I'll just say this on closing out on Title IX. There are, as I said, a number of lawsuits challenging Title IX. I truly believe that one of the lawsuits will result in a nationwide preliminary injunction, meaning that these rules will not go into effect. And hopefully the Biden administration will not be in power anymore. So these rules will never go into effect and we'll be able to roll back and continue on with Title IX as it was rewritten under the Trump administration. But for now, there is a letter that you can send to your school board on that resource page at momsforliberty.org. And you can take that letter and send it to your school district. Make school board members aware of where we are right now with Title IX, that there is no need for them to be making any changes and really put them on notice. You want your school board to be asking the superintendent, hey, superintendent, are we changing anything around gender ideology? I've got a lot of parents asking me. They're concerned about it and they want to know what's going to be happening with their kids in school. Really hold people's feet to the fire when you're dealing with these types of issues. They should be able to answer these questions for you.
And I'll agree with Tiffany that one of these cases is sure to lead to a nationwide injunction. There are already been several injunctions issued. So a number of states have already enjoined the application of Title IX to their school districts. I don't believe that Michigan is one of them, but it's spreading quickly.
Okay, we have California Gal. How do you recommend that parents question their children about what's happening at school? How do you recommend parents warn their children without taking away their innocence?
It's a really great question. You know, parents have the fundamental right to direct the upbringing of their children. That includes their education. But if parents are constantly reacting to things, they're not able to direct it. And so this is a really tricky situation that we're in because oftentimes you don't know this is happening until you speak to your child about it and they tell you. What are some of the best things you can do as a parent? First of all, keep the lines of communication open. If you're not having family dinner every night, I know it's hard for some families to do that, but try to be sharing a meal with your child and talking to them every day and just asking them questions about what's being taught in school and who they're talking to and what their teacher's like and all of those things. I understand it. It's delicate. As Dr. Grossman said, you want to get yourself aware and involved and to be educated on this issue. Do you have to be talking to your children about it? It depends if they're talking to your children about it at school. In some states, like in Montgomery County, Maryland, they're reading books about gender ideology and gender identity and sexual orientation in kindergarten. There's a book called Pride Puppy that's read. It's now part of the English language arts curriculum. And a judge recently there ruled that parents didn't have the right to opt their children out of this instruction. In that case, what do you need to do? You need to get your kid out of that school if you can. Honestly, that's the only thing that you're going to be able to do to safeguard them. I think the messages of there's no right way to be a boy or a girl. No child is born in the wrong body. You were made perfectly just as you are. You've always been a boy or a girl, as Dr. Grossman said. Those are the types of things that you can be saying to your children and reinforcing from a young age without giving them any idea about any of that. And then if they're, you know, approached with conflicting ideas at school, hopefully they're going to be like, this doesn't sound right because my parents told me that this is the way it is. And that's really the thing about, you know, raising a strong, confident child, giving them the opportunity to be able to push back. I'm sure there are probably some other suggestions from panelists.
My favorite suggestion, without a doubt, and it's my favorite part of every day. When I look back at my life in 40 years, the favorite parts of my life are going to be when I'm reading to my kids at bedtime. Because that's the time of the day when maybe they're just trying to delay going to sleep, but they start telling you about their day and what happened at school. And you have these great bonding moments. And at an age-appropriate level, of course, you need to be proactive with your kids and start teaching them about gender. You tell them, if you hear the word gender at school, I want to hear about it. And somehow, I mean, much of this is just due to my kids being amazing children all on their own. But I think my wife and I are okay as parents, And I've managed to keep my kids off social media. They don't want to be on it because we had these conversations proactively and they understand it's a negative, terrible place. And they don't have any of these issues with gender ideology at all. And in fact, they're a positive influence with other kids in their schools. They go to public school. I don't have to worry about a thing. I talk to the teachers. I even get to choose my kids' teachers because the principal knows they're going to have a problem on their hand if I get one of these teachers teaching gender ideology. But it's possible to do it, parents. But my number one recommendation is read to your kids. Just from a selfish standpoint, it's amazing. But it's probably the most powerful thing you can do for them as well.
So I'm being signaled here that we're kind of at the end of our time together. I'd like to go for another hour, but I want to be respectful of everybody's time. And there's one question that I want to just get answered quickly, and then we'll finish. So Smalay one, she says, my daughter was 14. And when she was 14, she said she was trans, but revoked after a few weeks. So I guess went back. I have read books and done research for about 10 years, and I'm a registered nurse. How do I get involved? Who can I work for? So this needs to be a quick answer.
Some of the people that are doing the best work, Jen Speck, Do No Harm. There are some great ones. Miriam, you know, please share some other ones. But I think you see that, you know, Do No Harm, where Miriam is a fellow, doing amazing work supporting parents. So I really highly recommend that group.
Yeah, there's
join Moms for Liberty.
Yeah, there is a long list of fantastic organizations that can be joined. You can volunteer. Again, my website has, I don't know, a long list of places. And I'm sure, Tiffany, your website probably also does as well. But I think that's great. We need more, especially medical people. That's fantastic. We need you. Please, you know, don't give up. You'll find the right thing to do. If anything, just like you can follow all these people on X that, you know, that you believe in and write good reviews on Amazon for, you know, there's a lot that you can do. But you know what? Speak to your friends and your family and people that you know and try to have an influence on them and try to bring the truth to them.
My quick add is just to get involved with your local school board. We see a lot of parents in your situation just going to school board meetings, paying attention, starting to speak out from, and with your medical background and your personal history, you have an important story to tell. So I just encourage you to look for opportunities to get engaged in that way.
Getting involved at the local level. Chris is right. Join Moms for Liberty. Run for school board. Make sure you're voting. Make sure you're asking people who are running for office where they stand on these issues of parental rights and gender ideology. It's an important question to ask, and it'll help inform your vote.
Okay. And sort of, you know, rapid fire round here. How do we reach your respective websites or toolkits? Now, let's start on the left. Let's start with Chris. Yeah.
Billboardchris.com. But really, I need to make that website better. Go to my Twitter account, X. Sorry, I just dead named X. My apologies. X, Billboard Chris. Same thing with Instagram. And try to come out with me maybe when I'm in your city. Come out on the street or go to university with me. You'll have your eyes open to what things are like out there.
You can reach information about our cases, about our resources at adflegal.org. We have a K-12 guide as well as a parent's toolkit that we're going to revamp again soon, and more resources coming out to try to reach parents and give you information about what's going on in the cases and how you can protect your kids.
Tiffany?
Go to momsforliberty.org, click on your state, see if we have a chapter in your county. If we don't, click to start one. Honestly, the greatest blessing of my life next to being a mom and a wife and is really working with amazing people across the country, these amazing moms and dads that are fighting for the future of America. You can follow us on social. And thank you so much for this opportunity, Jan. It was great to have this conversation.
And I think you also mentioned the Restore Childhood Toolkit, gendertoolkit.com. I'll just flag that for everybody. And then finally, Dr. Grossman.
Yeah, so I have a website, miriamgrossmanmd.com. There's a ton of good stuff on there, videos, my congressional testimony, and all sorts of good stuff. I'm also on X. This has been great. I want to just thank everybody. This has been fantastic.
Well, and now I want to thank everybody because it absolutely has been fantastic. We're going to put all those resources that you just mentioned below the video. If you're watching on, of course, on a computer or on the Epoch Times app, if it's on TV, you'll have to sort of enter those directly, but you can always come to our website, theepochtimes.com or epochtv.com more specifically. Finally, you know, we actually have a documentary. I just wanted to flag for everybody, if you hadn't seen it yet, it's called Gender Transformation, The Untold Realities. So that information about that documentary is also below. And it's done in this docudrama format, and it covers a lot of these realities that we discussed today. I would highly encourage you to go watch that film if you haven't already. Thank you all so much for joining us, and also to our panelists. I mean, this has been such a pleasure and an honor, and I look forward to speaking again.
Do you think you'd be happier as a boy?
My mom would never allow it. That's abuse.
Oh, you can hear me cry. See my dreams all die from where you're standing on your own.
Anybody who's gone through this, it's the same thing.
Sweetie, please.
No, no. I need you to
hold
leave.
Evie,
no.
Where are you getting this from?
We're just masquerading.
When did parents become enemy number one?
This is all coming from the top, the major corporations, governments, politicians.
You have a pipeline. It's also in the education system.
So today we're going to talk a bit about genders. We are here to support you.
I feel like I couldn't breathe. My aching body fell to the floor.
I've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of parents. Our stories are all the same.
They told my parents if I wasn't allowed to transition, I would be at risk of suicide.
This was a group where they basically gathered vulnerable children and taught them that it was us against them.
Would you rather have a dead daughter
or a living son?
That question is asked over and over again, and therapists are trained to say that.
You caused my heart to bleed.
Destroyed my hope.
Looking back, it made me feel even more hopeless.
And then I felt down, I felt tired, I felt exhausted.
Left half of my body shakes on its own uncontrollably.
I'll never be the same.
I was allowed to destroy my body.
They never talk about how much harm is being caused.
You know Joshua from Club?
Mm-hmm.
He says our closest family are often our worst enemies.
It's separating kids from their parents.
The state has decided that Evan should stay at a group home for now, for his safety.
See my dreams all die from where you're standing on your own.
We miss you so much, Evie.
Yeah. Leave him alone.
Like, this is the most important question. Why are they all doing this?